What is clear from historical data is that increasing interest rates doesn't necessarily work to solve inflation, but it works to curb the bargaining power of workers by increasing the unemployment rate.
Welcome to Jacobin Talks.
Hello, Clara.
This is a special episode today because it's my first one in English and we have a very special guest here. It's Clara Matej. She is professor of economics at the University of Tulsa in Oklahoma and wrote the phenomenal book, The Capital Order, How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. So our talk today is about how austerity policies are weakening the working class worldwide and strengthen fascism. The book will be published in German at Jacobin's publishing house Primär Verlag under the title Die Ordnung des Kapitals. It got a lot of attention in the English-speaking world and is already translated into 9 languages, and I hope that it finds a lot of German readers as well. We are very happy to have you here, Clara, and welcome to Berlin.
Thank you very much.
So, first of all, you dedicated your book at the beginning to Gianfranco Mattei and revolutionaries everywhere. Who is he?
Gianfranco Mattei was the brother of my grandfather, and he fought against the fascist resistance as a chemist. He was professor of chemistry, and he was making bombs during the time of the Nazi fascist occupation. And he was caught. He was tortured brutally for 4 days and decided to take his life, not to speak against his comrades. Gianfranco was fighting for the emancipation of Italian workers and for an actually democratic world. And I think it's very important that we take him as an example of the fact that being indifferent is not neutral. Being indifferent in this historical moment is taking sides. This is a famous thought of Antonio Gramsci saying indifference operates passively, but it operates as a very big force of history. Mm-hmm. And this is especially the case right now with the massacres in Gaza, is the fact that the artificially created indifference from the part of Western governments that are supporting the extermination of civilians and children and the whole infrastructure is something that needs to be fought against. And the idea of this book is to provide some tools that are conceptually capable of looking deeper at what are the expressions of this violence of advanced capitalism that are so crudely visible today in the suffering of the people in Palestine.
Very interesting. So the book is called The Capital Order, and maybe a wider question at the beginning. What exactly is this order? How does capitalism shape our social relations?
Yes, this is very important. So the title wants to steal what is ultimately the most important, I think, intuition of Karl Marx, which is the fact that capital as wealth, as money, as GDP growth is nothing but the manifestation of capital as a social relation. And this is unfortunately the most basic forgotten fact by the economics discipline, and which brings to the fact that capitalism is naturalized as the only possible economic system that we conceive of. And instead, the book tries to say capital is actually a political order. It's based on the subjugation of the majority of the citizens of this world in the fact that they have no alternative but to go work for a wage. Mm-hmm. And so the book reminds us that the capital order is nothing spontaneous. It's actually very fragile. And this is the empowering message of this book, is if you understand the political effort from the elite to preserve the semblance of immutability and of eternity through austerity policies, mm-hmm. which we will mm-hmm. discuss, mm-hmm. then you have this sense by which actually agency is still possible, change is still possible. It has to be courageous change to fight against what is the barbarism that is so obviously expressed in this historical moment. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And order has two different meanings in English. Like it's a structure and it is a command, right?
Yes, that's a very good point. Absolutely.
So then let's talk about the austerity and what role does it play in this capital order? Can you explain it a little bit?
Yes. The idea here is to use a historical lens mm-hmm. to overcome what I think is the banality and the technicality of current debates about austerity mm-hmm. that reduce austerity to, again, a technical tool that manages the economy as an object, as a given object. Mm-hmm. And this, the debate is between those who tell us that austerity is a technical necessity to improve our economy and those who tell us that actually austerity is bad economics because it's bad theory, and ultimately it doesn't help solve the debt problem and economic growth. What I say is that these two positions actually share something that is very important, which is the depoliticization mm-hmm. of the issue, because again, they take the capital order for granted. Yeah. So history helps us see that actually austerity is neither a technical necessity, it is a political choice, but it's also a very effective means. So it's not, unfortunately, just dismissible mm-hmm. as an easy mistake, as irrationality from the part of governments. That does not explain why it's alive and well for more than 100 years. What austerity does so well is protect the class balance that is required for any type of of capital accumulation, as we know it today, mm-hmm. of private investors to even happen. So austerity as a way to stabilize class relations and foreclose alternatives to capitalism. Mm-hmm. And this is what austerity is very good at.
Yeah. Let's go to the point of depolitization. But first of all, let's speak, what are the, you speak of a trinity of austerity policies. What yes. are these policies exactly? You know, what are the policies from austerity?
Thank you. This is important because, again, part of the way the public debate is misleading is mm-hmm. also in bad and vague definitions mm-hmm. Of concepts. And with austerity, it's very clear because usually when one discusses austerity, understands it as cuts in public expenditure mm-hmm. and increases in taxes. So a lens that looks at the whole, at the aggregate. And this lens of the aggregate that is the favorite of economists, of course, hides what is most important, which is actually the fact that what we should focus on is class relations mm-hmm. and who wins and who loses. And what you find out is that austerity is not just about budget cuts. It's about cuts in social expenditures, which is very different because cutting public healthcare, education, housing, transports. This is actually good for the economy because it increases the market dependence of people. So it's bad for people. It's socially and humanly mm-hmm. bad, but actually for the economy, it serves the fundamental function of trapping us into having to accept to go work for low wage mm-hmm. and precarious conditions, because that's the only way we can make a living. Mm-hmm. So it's cuts in social expenditures that goes with the state actively deciding to actually use the resources of the taxpayers to pay, for example, for the industrial military complex. The United States, for example, chooses to spend $93 billion in supporting the Israeli army, which basically means that Israel uses that money to buy weapons from American military corporations. And so the United States is constantly subsidizing private investors, the green asset managers. So all the green transition is actually all about incentivizing and supporting private investors, all sorts of ways to basically just maintain the two pillars of capitalism, mm-hmm. wage relations and private property of the means of production. This, there's no spontaneity in the market. The market is actively preserved via fiscal austerity. Mm-hmm. Fiscal austerity is also about regressive taxation. So the fact that, again, it's not just tax hikes. It's about the fact that you increase taxes on the workers, but you are detaxing income from capital. So what happens in many countries, including the United States and Italy and potentially also Germany, but I do not know the context enough, is that actually work is taxed more than capital. So this is clear in a variety of regressive tax choices that makes it such that, again, taxation is not a way to distribute resources from the top to the bottom, but the other way around. It increases the wealth of the capitalist while it increases our market dependence. This is fiscal austerity. Then, as you pointed out, there's a trinity. So then we have monetary austerity. Monetary austerity is what we are familiar with in the sense that it increases in interest rates. And increasing interest rates basically is, again, not a neutral way to solve the inflation problem, but a way to actually target the rate of exploitation. What is clear from historical data is that increasing interest rates doesn't necessarily work to solve inflation, but it works to curb the bargaining power of workers by increasing the unemployment rate. So again, something that hits labor relations, which is very important for our economic system. And finally, usually fiscal and monetary austerity are also combined with what I call industrial austerity. And that's about the state actively privatizing, actively deregulating labor. So of course, weakening the unions and creating the conditions through which it's easier to repress wages. This trinity that is very much active today operated very successfully after the First World War in a moment in which alternatives to capitalism were actually flourishing.
Let's talk about this later, but I have another question. So your term of austerity is one that it's class struggle. Austerity is a form of class struggle, isn't it? And that distinguishes you from like progressive Keynesianism. What do they think? What distinguishes you from them?
So that's why I think it's important, is that we need to avoid understanding the operation of the state as a technical neutral tool. The state is not a neutral institution. Already, the distinction between the market and the state is a completely artificial one, because actually what you see is that the capitalist economy functions thanks to the active role of the our governments and state institutions more generally to boost, again, what are the social political conditions that allow for private investment to happen in the first place. So definitely it's about class struggle. It's about our elite institutions taking part of constructing a world that is by definition anti-democratic. And the way they do this is, of course, by depoliticizing, in the sense of taking away the agency from people. And that's where I think progressive Keynesianism kind of takes for granted that taking away of the agency. They do not problematize that. They start from that assumption that is already part of the political struggle that allows for these conditions to operate in the first place.
So let's go to the history part of your book. You examine two historical cases of austerity policies after World War One, one in fascist Italy and the other one in liberal Britain. Why this both countries?
Yes, thank you. The choice of undertaking a comparative study between Italy and Britain is actually, I think, an important one, because it brings up thought-provoking insights about the unfortunate continuities and actual parallelisms between liberalism and fascism in how the capitalist economy is governed and protected. So what we note is that in the hub of the Western world, after the First World War, in a moment in which the large majority of the people thought that capitalism was not going to last mm-hmm. because it had proven its utmost violence during the Great War, and the fact that it was ultimately inefficient in organizing production and distribution for the sake of need, mm-hmm. Sake of need that is fundamentally incompatible with the logic of profit. So this large scale awareness was thwarted by austerity policies that were implemented in very similar ways in liberal Britain and fascist Italy. And there could not be any more like different institutional and political scenarios at the surface, of course, because we have Britain, the empire, you know, the hegemon that's now only after the First World War losing to the United States. Mm-hmm. But in a way, the form of advanced capitalism and the cradle of liberal democracy. And on the other hand, we have fascist Italy, which is a very dependent and backward, if you like, country, mm-hmm. very dependent on foreign capital and foreign primary sources. And at the same time, the birthplace of Benito Mussolini's fascist regime, who came to power in October of 1922. So these two settings show that actually, if you look at how technicians, experts, especially economists, who are the protagonist of my book, helped govern the economy, you find out that the austerity recipe was equally successful in both case scenarios. Of course, in Britain, it operated mostly through monetary austerity, again, using high interest rates that were hiked by the Bank of England and the Treasury in the spring of 1920 to eliminate the strikes, the unionization. And it's quite impressive how successful monetary austerity was in killing workers' demands. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, with that, we had Benito Mussolini, who directly used the power of the state to, by law, curtail wages, to outlaw unions and strikes. But anyway, the similarities are impressive. And the other point of the book is not only the parallelism, but the fact that actually you find out what is unfortunately a common, quite regular tendency in our capitalist economy, which is that of liberal governments supporting the rise of fascism because of fascist capacity to kill the revolutionary surges. I would just like to read a quote that is for me very emblematic. Even Montagu Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, who expressed awareness of the fact that under fascism, anything in the way of otherness was eliminated and opposition in any form was gone, added in the same breath, "The state of affairs is suitable at present and may provide for the moment the administration best adapted for Italy." He continued, "Fascism has surely brought order out of chaos over the last few years. Something of the kind was no doubt needed if the pendulum was not to swing too far in quite the other direction. The Duce was the right man at a critical moment." This is a letter written in 1926 to his friend Jack Morgan of Morgan Bank, now known as Chase Bank, who had a big role in supporting Mussolini financially. So again, I think these are reflections, the fact that actually fascism and liberalism unite when it's about protecting the capital order, that should make us think thoroughly about our present conditions.
Of course. And today we see that fascism is rising in the aftermath of austerity policies. How do you explain that?
So that speaks to the unfortunate success of austerity. And that actually for me is the expression of the success of austerity, in quotes, in the sense that it shows how austerity is very successful in disempowering the workers, in eliminating class awareness and class consciousness and individualizing us, both in terms of ideology. A lot of the book is about actually how economists construct the justification for austerity policies through their economic models that fundamentally eliminate the worker as a source of value to substitute the saver investor, who is considered now the center, the engine of the economic machine that everyone should thus, in a way, incentivize, of course, and protect and be grateful to, because of the capacity to employ those others who are lazier and less capable of saving. So the substitution of the labor theory of value with this theory of abstinence, which is a fundamental kernel of the passage from the classical political economy tradition to the neoclassical marginalist tradition that still dominates any economics textbook today, is actually key to understanding what austerity is about and how successful it is to clearly tell us that we should be angry at those who are weaker than us, the migrant, the poorest, rather than seeing the systemic oppression that comes from above. And so clearly, more austerity is capable of lending credence to far-right governments that clearly will not do less austerity, but more of it. But at the same time, the book is also about how fascism is the, in the first place was about austerity, right? So it's a vicious cycle, because fascism was never something different than capitalism on steroids. And this is very important, because a lot of the narrative tells us that fascism was not capitalist. No, fascism was the best government for the capital order that produces more fascism because of the capacity of austerity to kill us both materially and spiritually in terms of capacity to imagine an alternative future.
So let's look at the present. So politicians now, they wouldn't say we do now austerity policies. So, but we see this, yeah, everywhere. Can you give us an example, a country or where you see hard austerity policies now?
It's everywhere. They don't like to use the term anymore, because, of course, people recognized after the famous 2008-2009 debt, sovereign debt crisis. Again, sovereign debt. Why was there sovereign debt in the first place? Because the states had decided to actively use people's money to rescue big banks, big corporations, in a moment of economic downturn, right? So again, the fact that you're socializing the costs, and then, of course, who bears the cost are the workers through the austerity trinity. Today, austerity is everywhere. The Biden administration that saw the consequences of not appealing to people anymore, the complete downfall of the Democratic Party in the United States, speaks to the fact that it actually underwent very hardcore austerity. So while the lot of lavish money is spent on the military industrial complex, we see that actually absolute child poverty rate in the United States doubled just between 2022 and 2023 because of the government's choice to actually abolish all of the basically poverty relief efforts that had been put into place during the COVID period. So clear decisions to dismantle the social sectors, no effort at all to cure what is the huge social crisis in the United States right now, with soaring homelessness, 80% of the workers that are living paycheck to paycheck, meaning if there's any emergency, they end up in the street. We have 41% of Americans who cannot meet their basic needs. These are astonishing data points that show the collapse of American society. And this is the result of decades of austerity policies. So while interest rates go up and capital holders get constantly more enriched by just lending their money, we have a situation of dismantling social services, further subsidies and privatizations, especially with fracking and all the supposed, you know, efforts to go green. And of course, attempts to constantly counteract against the unions. Mm. And of course, Trump will not do any better, unfortunately, on all of these lines.
But a lot of people would say now, okay, the GDP in America, in the US goes up and we had the Bidenomics, like in investive politics. Isn't it the opposite of austerity?
Bidenomics is largely a farce. Bidenomics was not much other than basically stimulate the military-industrial complex and stimulate big asset managers. Bidenomics was not able to do any of the promises that had been brought out during the early years of the Biden campaign, which was actually about building better, of actually providing social housing, of actually providing understanding that college tuition was a problem, of actually giving to people. Bidenomics gave nothing to people. It gave a lot to the corporations, the asset managers, those same that were supporting the Harris campaign. And of course, unfortunately, the same that are supporting now the Trump government. Markets soared at the idea that Trump is now in power because Trump will do more austerity. So we see that the point is that austerity cuts across party lines. Mm-hmm. Austerity is something that a lot of the self-understood left is willing to undertake because this is what is required for the good governance of a capitalist economy. Sure, then the economy grows. But if you look at then how the wealth is distributed, you find out that the rate of exploitation, that is, you can calculate by looking at how much of the GDP goes to profit with respect to how much of the GDP goes to wages, the rate of exploitation keeps increasing in the United States and the level of working poor also keep going up. This is the same you see in Italy right now. The Giorgia Meloni government that was elected with an idea that she would do something different is now following the script of the austerity trinity in a very, very violent way. She even eliminated these meager subsidies that were going to the most marginalized through the citizenship income, which was something like 500 a month to euros a month to families. And, you know, we have a situation by which one fourth of the Italian workers now are making less than 700 euros a month. This while the billionaires keep multiplying in Italy, they keep increasing while, again, absolute poverty also keeps increasing. This is a common reality that I'm sure also the German context is seeing. And it needs to be fought by really a radically different script.
Let's go to this. So you described the violence of this policies of austerity, but how can the working class organize against it? Or where do you see now political movements or parties that can build an opposite to this?
So my own contribution to the struggle is to deconstruct beliefs that ultimately, a lot of the times capture the so-called left as well, right? Mm-hmm. The belief of the neutrality of economics as a science, the belief that there is something as the good of the whole under capitalism. These are all beliefs that need to be dismantled. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think history can lend a hand because history is able to reveal what just, abstract general discussions don't really convincingly show. Mm. So if we look at historically at how classist are the economic assumptions that govern our current economy, we stop thinking about the economy as a neutral object. Mm-hmm. That is somehow, we should all hope that it goes, the economy is run well because we'll all gain. No, that's false and it needs to be brought back to the table. And that's why we need a class analysis that is often, too often forgotten by a lot of people on the ground. So this is the contribution, let's say, on an intellectual level that I think can help to empower what are obviously the struggles that are happening on the ground. Because that's the other farce, is to convince us that there is no opposition. There's a ton of opposition. I'm living, unfortunately, in the United States right now. And I say unfortunately because my own tax money are going to the genocide in Gaza. And this is something that I can't really sleep at night about. I think anyone who is a little bit still human has a really hard time like actually going about their day in this historical moment. And what I was saying is that in the United States, there's a lot of struggles that happen on the ground. Mm. It's not the Democratic Party. It's not, it's actually grassroots level organizing of solidarity amongst neighbors that are losing their homes. It's about grassroots solidarity for the Palestinian cause that is actually so courageous. And these students are like risking their careers to stand up against this ultimate expression of how the capitalist economy runs through the destruction of people and lives. So there's a lot actually of struggle, and there's a lot of grassroots organization. In the United States, these new unions that are emerging everywhere are organized in a way that is very different from the typical kind of hierarchical union concept of the traditional unions. So the struggles are many, especially in the global South, of course. There is a lot going on everywhere. For example, I was in Brazil where they translated my work in August, and, you know, the MST movement, the land movement of landless workers, is more active than ever right now. They are reclaiming new land. They are pressuring the government to allow them to run a production of food in a democratic way. And that's a real political struggle because it's, of course, going against the principles of private property of the means of production. And other movements about occupying buildings and building, and this is something that happens also in Italy, struggles to maintain a collective space of existence. These are really moments in which people understand that being political is essential to human beings because it's about governing our basic needs. And this is how people actually get together and say, we can't just focus on parliamentary politics. Parliamentary politics can change if there is participation on the ground. And I tell my students, in order to actually do critical economics, you have to participate and explore and be curious. And this is actually the grounding principle of the new center I'm opening, the CHE. The reason why I'm moving from New York, the new school where I've taught for over 8 years now, as associate professor, is because I'm going to be directing the CHE, the Center for Heterodox Economics. And the idea of the center is that it's not just academic. Of course, we will build a curriculum that is critical of the mainstream, but you can only be critical if you're actually on the ground with organizations, with the connection with citizens. And that's what we're trying to do, is actually finally go back to what Gramsci inspired us by telling us it's about praxis. It's, you only get new knowledge if you do things for real.
That sounds nice. Thank you very much for the talk, Clara.
Thank you so much for having me.